You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McCuver, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. We're over here at the Old Mill Road Recording Studios in East Arlington, Vermont, with a special guest today. Ben Lerner is the composer in residence of the Old Mill Road Studios, and he's got a special anniversary coming up in a few days. On June 13th, 2016, he had his last experience with alcohol and other drugs, and is about to celebrate a fifth-year anniversary of sobriety, and that's quite a remarkable achievement. Ben, congratulations on that. In advance. I realize it's one day at a time, and we still got another 11 days to go, but I think your track record is pretty solid. Ben, as many of you know, writes a column that appears in the Vermont News Guide called Clean. He also is a host of Clean Jams on the radio station WEQX, and also writes articles for us that appear in Stratton Magazine and Vermont Magazine. And when he's not doing any of those things, he's also a musician as well, and a very accomplished one, too, I might add. Well, Ben, again, congratulations on a remarkable achievement. I guess I was just wondering, just to kind of get us started, can you tell us a little bit about what was going on with you back in early June of 2016? Where were you at in terms of your situation, and what made that moment on June 13th the time when you said, I'm done?
Well, I was a full-blown IV heroin and crack cocaine addict, not to put too blunt of a point on it, but I want people to know, you know, that recovery is possible. And so starting out, I got to talk about how bad it got and how deep my addiction got. But where it all started from is before I ever had my first drink or drug, I was an addict with alcoholic and addictive tendencies long before I ever used mind-altering substances to get there. And over the years, you know, it went from just seeking out approval as a drug, trying to get people to pay attention to me, give me validation. That was when I was a kid, had my first drink at 14, and, you know, at first the consequences were pretty suburban, missing the class, you know, showing up late to a piano judging. But then as I got older, the consequences got more severe. Started getting DUIs, getting arrested, you know, dropping out of school, forgoing all my commitments and all my passions for another bag of what became, you know, weed, coke, oxys, dope, and then crossing every line I thought I wouldn't cross. And, you know, I still thought that my use was justified going into June 2016, and I honestly also thought that everyone who was impeding me from getting high wasn't just not doing me a favor, they weren't doing themselves a favor. I thought if they only understood how much pain I was in, they would get right out of my way. And I thought everybody else was in my way. And so, you know, early June came around, and I stopped getting high. And it's not that I stopped getting physically high or chemically high, it's that I stopped getting spiritually and emotionally high. And the drugs didn't take me where I wanted to go. And I had been to rehab before, I had been to treatment centers, outpatient, inpatient before, but I had never really made the commitment to get sober for myself. But at this point I was out of options, because not only was I running out of money and bridges to burn, but I just didn't really get high anymore. And I knew that my three options were try to overdose, try to keep using and hope that I can find some semblance of peace and serenity that the drugs used to give me, or try something different and actually try to get sober. So June 13th, 2016, I shot dope for the last time, and I didn't think it was going to work getting sober, but I went to a treatment center, inpatient treatment center, and I haven't felt the need to use a drink or drug ever since.
I've heard many folks who've struggled with substance abuse say that they just hit a bottom, that something really horrible happened, like they were in a car accident, or they did something that they never ever thought they would do, assaulted a family member, let's say, or did something really, really bad. And that was the point they said, okay, I got to stop. But it sounds like you came to a realization about that without having to go through, you know, a really bottom experience.
Oh, there were some bottoms. I mean, like I say, I was an IV heroin and crack cocaine addict, and some people can do that functionally. I'm incredibly surprised at people who didn't experience the same level of consequences, and I wasn't homeless. You know, there were certain lines I didn't cross, I never sold my body, never did anything like that, but everyone, regardless of what lines they crossed, the real bottom isn't the, like, you know, physical consequences, the psychological, it's not the physical consequences, it's not the monetary consequences, it's not what way you use the drugs, it's the psychological consequences. And it's like, you know, the deep emotional bottom, and everyone is kind of the same that way. But honestly, when I was at those low bottoms, I justified my use because of them. It wasn't like, oh, drugs took this away from me, they did this horrible thing in my life, so I'm going to stop using. It's no, self-fulfilling prophecy. Drugs did this to me, so I better keep using to run away from it. But like I said, you know, I had all the drugs I wanted. I was in a place where I was using with another friend. It wasn't because I was dope sick or withdrawing that I wanted to go to treatment. It was just that I don't know if this is too simple. It got old. I mean, at a certain point, you use so many drugs that they just become white noise, and it doesn't really stifle any of the pain anymore. It doesn't keep you away from your truth. And I was just running from the truth for so long that every single bottom I experienced just made me want to use more. But it was when I realized that the drugs weren't taking me where I needed to go that I realized, wow, maybe sobriety is the next best option. And it ultimately became the best option and the thing that saved my life.
What do you think was the difference that allowed you to continue on that sober path?
Well, I think I misspoke earlier when I said I haven't felt the need to use a drug or drink ever since. I haven't drank and I haven't used drugs, but I feel like I want to use every single day. And I know that might be scary to some people who are dealing with families who are dealing with addicts in recovery. But for me, what it just comes down to is, the reason I'm able to stay sober is because I don't forget that I'm an addict. I don't try to leave it behind. And I'm a member of a recovery fellowship, and one of the old adages from that fellowship is, neither regret the past nor wish to shut the door behind it. What that means to me is I confront the fact that I'm an addict on a daily basis. I confront my addictive tendencies separate from the substance abuse. Because if I get complacent and I forget that there is an addict who is willing to forego everything in his life, leave his family, leave his friends, leave all his accomplishments and passions behind just for one more hit, I'm going to go back out there. And it's tough because you don't want to wallow in self-pity and self-contempt, but you also don't want to underestimate the power of the disease. So I guess if, you know, separate from, you know, recovery fellowships, job opportunities, inpatient, outpatient treatments, the support of my loving family, my mother's in recovery, she played a huge, valuable part in all that support. I stay in the solution by remembering the problem. I stay in the solution by remembering where it can take me, and I play that tape back, as they say in the recovery fellowship, because if I don't play that tape, I'm right back at square one, and I'm thinking I'm going to get slick and I can use a drug. But if I remember that it takes me to that point that I can't go to, I can keep moving forward and keep doing what I'm doing and not have any illusions about where it takes me.
Tell us about your story since then, since June 3rd of 2016. You were able to get sober, you were able to stop using heroin. What followed from there?
Well, every month brought its own breakthrough since June 13th, 2016. I mean, the first month was in treatment, and the first breakthrough I had there was that I wanted to leave and I didn't. And I was looking at my reflection in the mirror, and I realized I could lie to everyone else successfully. Addicts are very manipulative. We're good at getting what we want, but I couldn't lie to myself anymore. I couldn't convince myself that using was the best course of action anymore. And so I decided to stay. It was the best decision that I ever made. But there are a bunch of best decisions that I ever made. And the best decision I make actually is every day that I decide to stay sober and clean. And it's a decision I have to make every day, make no mistake. I got sober, you know, left treatment, got a job. And it wasn't a top-of-the-line tech job. I didn't have a college degree. I still don't have a college degree. I worked as a busboy. And I applied to dozens of jobs before they accepted me. And, you know, I wasn't looking good. I had a second adolescence disorder, pockmarked oily skin, because the drugs had been sapping my life force for so long, it came back with a vengeance. I had a second teenagehood of sorts. And, you know, I'm working at this place, and it's like a kind of fancy bistro. And I'm from Washington, D.C., if you can't tell from my accent. I ain't a native Vermonter, but I've been coming up here since I was a little kid. And, you know, I'm working at this restaurant. I'm carrying these plates, and I got all these track marks on my arms. From using IV heroin. So I got a shirt and it's rolled all the way up. And actually today I have a tattoo here and tell the story of that kind of for a metaphor of what I've done with my recovery and what I try to do every day. And I'm at this restaurant, I'm carrying these plates and my hands are sweaty because it's 90 degrees out, hot, humid DC day. And so I sweat and I drop the plates and I'm like, that's it. I don't care if anyone sees my track marks. I'm rolling up my sleeves. I'm going to keep working. So I go inside and sure enough, someone makes a comment. They say, hey man, what's up with those scars? And I kind of froze because I was like, what am I going to do? Do I lie? Do I risk losing my job to tell them the truth? And that was another kind of aha moment because I was like, you know what? I'm not going to get anywhere by lying. It's more work. It's not some whole like self-righteous honesty crusade. It's just like, it's going to be so much more work and it's going to torment me so much more if I don't just tell the truth. And it's not always easy to tell the truth. I've had people, you know, across the time get really angry at me for being an addict based on their own experiences, take out their anger and vitriol towards me based on their own experience, and they got their own pain. Not everyone's accepting, but when I told the person in the restaurant that I was an addict, they accepted me, and that little gesture of kindness fueled my journey forward, and that's resulted in me having the confidence to get the job I have here now, to get back at the piano and start making music, to start writing again. And all of that stems from one single moment, which is deciding that truth is more important than self-preservation.
How important is it to have a support structure like AA or NA or some of the other organizations that are out there? I mean, I've heard of people who've achieved sobriety without that, just on their own. But it seems like for a lot of people, having that outside support is really critical.
Yeah, everybody gets sober by themselves and everybody stays sober with a community. And, you know, people don't get sober always completely by themselves. I mean, that's an overstatement. You go to a treatment center, you go to a recovery program, and there's other people who help you. But I guess what I mean to say is nobody can bear the brunt of detoxing from a chemical but you. And I've heard a lot of parents actually say, I wish I could detox for my kids, because that's the hardest thing for them, is they just don't want to be sick. They don't want to get the shakes from drinking. They don't want to be dope sick. I wish I could detox for them, but I can't. But after I went through the detox program by myself, I had to make the decision that not only was I willing to tell the truth like I did at that restaurant and like I do through my writing today and through Clean Jams and through the Clean Column and through my music, I had to make sure that I was honest with my higher power and I was honest with the people in my recovery network. And that's just more accountability. That's more honesty. You could talk about, you know, 12-step fellowships, Smart Recovery, Celebrate Recovery, you know, psychiatric help, faith-based groups, and all that plays a part. Family, friends, you know, the whole community. I've heard it said, you know, addiction is a family disease. I think it's a community disease. I think everybody plays a part in recovery, whether negative or positive. But it's also, you know, accountability on the addict's part. But in order to maintain that accountability, they have to stay connected to some sort of program or some sort of fellowship. And I've got what works for me. I don't speak on it publicly because anonymous fellowships are of that nature that you don't reveal that. But I will say that the connections I've formed, regardless of what fellowship I'm in, have greatly helped me. And connections are only good if you use them, and they're only good if you're honest to the people in your network. Because if you hold anything back in your program or your connections, you're not going to get anything back from it. You get out what you put in, and so I'm grateful for my network, and I think anyone who wants to stay sober, regardless of what type of network it is, they should get involved with one. Because, again, like in that treatment center, when I was only lying to myself and, you know, trying to convince other people, but I knew I wasn't okay. If you know you're not okay and you know you need some help from people, the only bad thing that can happen is going to happen to you. Nothing bad is going to happen to anyone else if you don't ask for help. So I would encourage people to ask for help and get out there.
I just wanted to circle back for a minute to something you were saying earlier about, you know, waking up each morning and deciding that today I'm going to stay sober and not use anything, you know, for today. I mean, do you go through any kind of morning ritual or meditation or anything like that where you kind of just sort of take a few minutes to kind of center those thoughts? Is that part of the morning routine?
It's actually the night routine for me. It's kind of a cleansing thing. I check in with my higher power, do a little bit of meditation, prayer, whatever you want to call it, because anybody's spiritual journey, I don't really like to speak so much on the specifics of my spiritual journey because I've heard it said it's better to identify in than identify out, but I do have a ritual, and more than that, my entire day is based off of the principle of awareness and detachment. And a lot of fellowships have, you know, faith-based fellowships outside of, like, you know, the sobriety community have names for this. You know, the Buddhists call it enlightenment. You know, Abrahamic theology, it's compassion, it's family, it's the Ten Commandments. But, you know, at the end of the day, what it really boils down to for me is I need to be able to be present in the reality. And I need to be aware of what's going on. And if you get away from chemicals, you get that awareness, whether you like it or not. Your senses come back awake, and it hits you. And so then the question is, how do you apply the principles you learn from your sobriety fellowship or your psychological psychiatric program or your faith group towards your journey of recovery? And for me, what it means is I need to be able to take a breath. I need to be able to detach from my physical, emotional, and spiritual tension. I need to ground myself in the moment, and I need to say, you know, it's okay that I'm having these feelings. It's a common misconception that the goal of recovery, at least from where I stand, is you're never going to feel angry. You're never going to feel triggered to use. You're never going to feel sad. You're never going to feel disappointment. I feel those feelings every day, whether in a big or small way. It's how you deal with them. And it's that you finally have the tools to be able to deal with them in a non-chemical and sustainable way. And so to answer your question, yes, I meditate and, you know, pray on a daily basis. And I don't just do it in a ritual, ceremonial way. I do it every single moment when something happens that's frustrating, that's painful. I breathe, center myself. I try to remember my training, remember my principles, and utilize those tools. Because recovery isn't static. It's in every single moment. And there's always an opportunity, whether it's a good day or a bad day, to re-solidify your recovery.
I've heard that term trigger used a lot. You know, people have told me that there are all kinds of triggers out there. A lot of times it can be stress from work. Sometimes it can be something as innocuous as the weather. It's a nice day out. Great day to drink a beer. It's a rainy day out. Good day for something else. Are there certain triggers that you've felt that when they occur or you feel that feeling coming on, you go, okay, time out. I got to like back away from this for a second.
Everybody's different. My main trigger is pain and isolation. I was born and diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. So another trigger is a sensory overload. If I experience too many emotions, if too many people come at me, if there's too many social cues that I miss, I kind of get in this kind of dissociative fog of confusion and self-hatred, because I feel like everybody's out to get me, and like it just kind of snowballs and gets worse and worse. And substances, I don't want to say they solved it, but they detached me chemically from my problems so much that I could convince myself that I was okay. And so now that chemicals aren't my solution, I have to learn how to navigate those triggering situations without chemicals. And the program that I'm part of has really helped me. And just breathing, honestly, has really helped me. And I know that sounds corny and folky and outdated and whatever, but I was absolutely amazed when I got sober how I wasn't breathing when I got stressed. I was holding my breath. I was clenching my fists. And because I hold a lot of tension naturally, and the drugs help me escape that. I use downers. But other people who want to be the life of the party, they use, you know, alcohol, stimulants. Not that alcohol is a stimulant, but it's often paired. And their goal is to get engaged. You know, like you say, it's a nice day, I want a beer. And the common adage of, you know, recovery fellowships is, I drank because it was a great day, I drank because it's a bad day. So there are triggers in every situation. But I've been able to get past those triggers by grounding myself firmly in the fact that my body is a roller coaster, but I control the speed and I'm the operator. And as long as drugs are in my system, they're the operator. I answer to them. And on some days, it's harder to run my own show and, you know, detach from my tension and kind of slow it down. But as long as I can just remember that, you know, I have the capability of being serene and being present, and it's up to me to breathe and just let stuff go, I can face those triggers and I can stay sober another day.
It's fascinating to me how paradoxical using can be, and like you use when things are going well, you know, you've had a success in life, something's worked out, and then you can also justify using when things aren't going well, you know, like, oh man, I screwed that up or whatever. It's just interesting how either side of the equation can justify using whatever it is that you're involved with.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say though, on the flip of that, anything can justify sobriety. You can stay sober on a beautiful day and really enjoy the sunshine. Like, I didn't know when I was still shooting dope that sunshine actually, you know, provides some of the same endorphins and the same warm feeling. Because my sunshine came in a bag. And, you know, on sad days, on tragic days, I didn't know that it was possible to really cathartically deal with that grief and let it go rather than just pile some dope or alcohol on top of it and press it down. Because eventually you deal with it regardless. So I would say, yeah, definitely, it's a paradox that, you know, using can come and like people can turn to it on happy or sad days, but recovery can also be used in that same way. And it's been amazing to me how it's made it easier for me to enjoy good days and navigate tough days in recovery, because I'm present for it and because I'm actually experiencing it, and there's no chemical buffer, and there's no way to put a price on that.
What do you make of the whole thing about stigma? I've heard that term used a lot in like opioid forums or whatever that I've listened to, or people I've talked to who've had family members struggle with addiction. Is that one of the big things that holds people back from trying to go out for recovery is the whole stigma, the shame of being an alcoholic or a drug user? Is that a big part of the whole process you have to overcome in order to get into a recovery situation?
Yeah, you have to get right with yourself before you can get right with your life and get right with your higher power, certainly. And, you know, stigma in terms of how people express it with their words on public forums, on social media sites, is certainly detrimental to the success of addicts, because addicts are sensitive people. I mean, if you're muting out the feelings that you have with outside chemicals, that means the feelings mean something to you. And I know they did for me. I know it hurt me when people said that I was a no good addict. And it hurt more when, you know, I resorted to behavior patterns. It's kind of a self-fulfilling cycle, but because someone tells me that I'm not okay and that I'm a horrible person, and then I self-medicate to forget the stigma. And so, yeah, it's a horrible, you know, kind of mythical, like Greek Sisyphus putting the boulder up the hill only to have it roll down type deal. But apart from that, dealing with stigma in addiction is certainly, you know, tough and prevents a lot of people from finding recovery, but dealing with stigma in recovery is also very tough. And that's what me and Dr. Joshua Sherman's multi-pronged advocacy campaign with the show, with Clean Jams, with the Vermont News Guide column, and with the album is seeking. I don't think eradicate's really a fair term, although, yeah, that's the goal. But you know, addicts need jobs, and addicts need a place to live, and addicts need acceptance in recovery, not just in addiction. That's a huge part of it. Treatment is a huge part of it, but one of my primary visions and missions in this whole recovery advocacy game is to make sure that people understand that treatment doesn't end at the treatment center. And just because you're okay with an addict getting treatment and you're supporting them in that, that's great. But there's a lot of people that say, oh, recovery house, not in my backyard. Oh, it's great that addicts get a job. I don't want them in charge of my cash register. And I get it. You know, addiction's a community disease. It takes an impact. If an addict steals from you, wrongs you, burns a bridge, or whatever, people don't want to get burned. That's the phrase that I keep hearing over and over again, is people don't want to get burned. And I understand that. But what I will say is, if someone hadn't been willing to overlook their stigma and personal doubts about addicts and give me a chance at a low-level job and let me work up, if my family hadn't given me a chance to go to treatment, and if, you know, the people in my life hadn't allowed me to make up what I did in the past to them because of their preconceived doubts and stigmas and their prejudice towards addiction as a disease and as, you know, like a situation, I wouldn't be where I am today. So I would encourage people to, just like I have to be aware of who I am as an addict to make it through the day, people who aren't addicts should be aware of their stigma. Don't hate yourself for it. Just accept it and look at it the same way I have to look at myself as an addict every day and be accountable for what I did. Stigma is something you got to be accountable about. It's something that at the end of the day you have to say, am I being compassionate? Am I being helpful? And it's scary. Just like it's scary for me to stay sober every day, it's scary to trust an addict, just like it's scary for me to trust myself. But I find that when people can be open, accepting, and honest with themselves and with other people, it creates positive results. And so, to me, that's what overcoming stigma is about. Being honest, looking at yourself objectively and saying, am I willing to forgive people and be compassionate moving forward?
How important is it to make amends to people that you may have hurt, maybe unintentionally or intentionally, but you know, you look at it later, you know, from the standpoint of recovery and say, wow, you know, I really hurt that person. I didn't mean to, but that's how it happened. Is it important to say, I'm sorry to that person to assist your own recovery to go forward, or is it just sort of a nice thing to do, but it really doesn't play a central role in your own recovery?
It's a huge tenet of many programs, and I think it's very important. I think it's important to make up to people, and it's important to know within yourself that you've done everything you can, but to be honest, there's a lot of things that I'm never going to be able to make up for just because due to the nature of my addiction, I wronged a lot of people I've never even met face to face. And so that's why someone I worked with early on in my program of recovery said, you got your family, you got your friends, you're doing everything you can to make those amends to those people. The biggest amend that you can make to the people whose actions made you inadvertently wrong them, your actions inadvertently wronged, is to stay sober. And to help other people so that down the line they don't get wronged by another addict. And they don't have to experience the same tragedy and pain that you caused them. And so I think the concept of living amends is very important. Because a lot of people who can never repay for the damage that they did financially, emotionally, they're going to carry that burden for the rest of their lives. But they're also going to carry the potential for being able to heal another addict. And have their sobriety be a force of good, just like their addiction was a force of destruction. And for me, that comes down to, I'm never going to fully repair all the damage that I did, just like I'm never going to fully repair the scars on my arms. And I think that's a metaphor, though, because if you take your pain and use it to motivate good, then the pain was worth something. And if you take your pain and use it to motivate destruction, then it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy of doom that drags everyone down. So what I would encourage people is, yes, go out and make amends whenever you can. It's important for you. It's important for your program. Sure. But I don't want to be overly preachy about specific amends, because the truth is that living amends and just staying sober, staying clean, and helping other addicts, helping your family, helping your community, helping your recovery circle, that's the real way you pay back the world, at least for me.
And finally, before we have to run, I guess I was wondering what your thoughts have been about the last 14 or 15 months or so during the pandemic. What has your observation been around that? Has it been really a tough time for folks in recovery?
Yeah, it's been the toughest time in my entire recovery. There's no sugarcoating it. But there's also been a lot of hope. There's a lot of sadness, a lot of destruction, a lot of relapses. But I've seen a lot of people come together like never before, and I was actually, hanging out with some people in recovery the other day, and I was amazed, like, meeting new people, how many of them got sober in 2020 and 2021, and that's so inspiring to me, because at this time when, you know, meetings were only over Zoom, and people were unemployed, people were laid off, people were dealing with financial insecurity, food insecurity, I mean, you name it, it's a tumultuous time. But just like, you know, having a tumultuous time in your life, regardless of whether there's an international global pandemic making it harder, you can use those tumultuous times to motivate recovery. And you can use those painful experiences to move forward. So yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, overdose numbers have spiked. I mean, overdose deaths have spiked. Let's be honest about it. And it's tough. You know, fentanyl's out there. Alcohol is at every liquor store. And, you know, it's easier to do that than it is to get sober. But in the long run, it's really not. It's really not easier to keep putting yourself on that corner or up in that bar and not deal with your emotions and not deal with the consequences of your actions. And I would say that even though the pandemic's still raging, you know, we're turning a little corner, hopefully, you know, knock on wood, but there is no bad time to seek out recovery. There is no bad time, and the worst of times provide the moments. Just like you talked about those bottoms earlier, I think everybody in the world now knows what it's like to go through some sort of isolated bottom. And I said to Dr. Joshua Sherman during one of our talks during the pandemic when he was checking in with me, he's like, how are you doing? And I said, well, Josh, I think everybody knows what it's like to be alone in their room, not trust anybody, and not want to go outside for fear of people. And that's how I felt when I was an actively using addict. And it was tough for me to get out of that because, again, you know, I'm getting sober, I'm getting clean, finally. And I'm back out in the world and I'm not wearing a mask to try to hide myself. And then they're telling you, wear a mask, stay inside again. And that isolation was killer. But what allowed me to get through it was the supportive community of recovering addicts. And the fact that being sober just feels better. And it's sustainable clarity and it's a beautiful thing. And regardless of how gray the skies are, how sunny the skies are, metaphorically or literally, staying sober allows me to experience it, move forward, and grow. And so I'm grateful for it, regardless of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Hope you found the program interesting. And for those of you who may be feeling that it's time for you to kind of make an inventory of some of those issues that you may be feeling, there's help out there. And I'm sure you can help them out, Ben, if anyone wanted to reach out to you. Anyway, thanks again. Congratulations. Thank you all. And we'll see you again the next time.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.